This is Peter Atkinson giving a shout out to all of you out there listening to Gamers Haven and also Fistful of Comics. Keep it up.
Stand by for action.
Gamers Haven Special Edition.
Cowboy Quarterly is a magazine with big shoes to fill, keeps growing. Delighted to say that their articles, interviews, and new magic classes and monsters are reaching more and more readers with every issue. And gamers are liking what they see. If you have an article you'd like to see, you can write them a letter. If you're a subscriber or open design patron, you can send them a query for an article. They're open designers. One or two projects each year, they're written as open design commissions, funded by gamers who gain input into the final adventure or source book. We learn about steps involved in moving from idea to final publication. These projects are discussed on the Free City site and the Open Design blog. You go to www.koboldquarterly.com, perpetuated by Wolfgang Bauer.
Nathan had a chance to sit down with Jonathan Ritchie from Sci-Fi Games. He was there with the Mindstorm Labs guys to talk about his new card game called Juggernaut. So sit down and enjoy this good 8-minute interview with this gentleman.
This is Nathan with the Gamers Haven podcast, and I'm currently talking to Jonathan Ritchie of... I'm sorry, I don't know the name of your company.
Sci-Fi Games. We're with Mindstorm.
Sci-Fi Games with Mindstorm Labs. Here at Gen Con, and this young gentleman has created a wonderful new card game called Juggernaut. Some interesting facts about this card game, if I remember correctly. This card game has been in the works since he was approximately in fifth grade.
Yeah.
And he used it as a project in high school and did a good job on his project and managed to get a grant from the Canadian government to actually publish this product as an official product for sale in 12th grade.
Yeah, that's it.
Can you tell us a little bit about the game?
Well, Juggernaut is basically a space battle game. You've got a fleet of warships, and your kind of goal is to wipe out everybody else through just the cards that you're dealt, but also by, you know, getting other people in and using diplomacy to team up for other people and that sort of thing.
So how many people can actually play this game at one time?
Ranges from 2 to 8 people. We recommend a max of 6. Just because after that the game gets a little bit crazy, but
okay.
Yeah, each deck that we have can easily do 8.
Easily accommodate 8 people. Do you have any plans to actually release any expansion packs for it to add additional features or maybe additional enemies and teams?
Yeah, that's we're currently in the works. Actually, what we want to do is kind of 3 different sets of expansions. One is games that can be played independently or in conjunction with the actual Juggernaut product. So we have about 2 of those that have kind of been floating around in my head, but we're going to think about that further. Also, expansions to the game itself, just to add new features or different things to it. It's pretty easy to add stuff on. And the third is going to be small booster packs that we're doing. We want to set up a place on our website where we can get fans to come in and say, I have this idea, and then get other fans to look at it and say, this idea is good, but it might not work. You know exactly like this, so you should alter it to this. And then once we have those submissions, and you know people have looked at them for a while,
then we'll
put them through. We'll put them into little packs that are all fan-created kind of booster packs. And just
have you thought about getting fan-created artwork for those cards as well?
I hadn't really thought about it, but I mean, I'm sure it would be... Definitely.
It would keep artwork costs down, especially if they're going to require you to actually do...
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, it's a great thing, too, to be able to put... You know, it's easy to put people's names on it and say, look what they did, you know?
Now, if I remember correctly, also, the artwork that's on the cards was all done by your grade when you released the product, correct?
Some of the ship designs were done by artists, yeah, that were just in my grade.
Okay.
Most of the artwork I did myself.
So you've done most of the artwork for the cards yourself?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Now, did you use those hand-drawn, or did you actually use, like, a computer program to make
them? Both.
Both?
Yeah. So the Pepperly and the Tragedies, the blue and the green, were hand-drawn, and then I did a few touch-ups in Photoshop just to make it fit with the rest of everything else.
Excellent.
Everything else was all done just a combination of, like, basically scanned it into the computer, fixed it up, changed it around.
Well, I must say that the artwork is very unique and it's very good. And if anybody is curious about this product, he actually has a website available that you can order it from, correct?
Yeah, www.corvion.com. That's K-O-R-V-I-O-N.
.com.
So,
okay.
Yeah.
And can you tell us a little bit about the process it was to go with the government to actually get the grant?
That was actually surprisingly one of the easier things to do. We basically showed them our business plan, said this is what we want to do, this is how much it's going to cost to print the cards, this is how much, you know, we plan to sell the stuff for, and, you know, showed them all that, and they thought that, you know, that looked good. They saw that we could actually do something with this, and so helped us out in that way, so that wasn't too bad.
Now, if I remember correctly, you said in the first year that you released the product, you sold 1,000 copies, correct?
Yeah, that's
right. With no advertisement?
Well, it kind of, there was a little. We got two articles in the paper just talking about.
But they were local papers.
Yeah, there was just local papers, like, probably just around the town, that sort
okay.
of thing. And what also happened is a teacher got hold of the copy of the game and was like, hey, we could use this for math. Like, I'd never even considered that.
Well, yeah, there's
before,
a considerable amount of math to the actual process of.
Yeah, adding and subtracting the stuff, but I guess they figured it was just so easy to pick up and play, they could teach their kids no problem. So they did it. The kids liked it so much that it actually, you know, word got through the district. The district ordered a couple hundred, and then from there, the kids all got it, and then they all wanted the games for themselves, so it just, like, took off.
It spiraled.
Yeah, yeah.
Excellent.
So, yeah.
Now, you said that the process of actually going through to come here was a little bit of a problem. What actually happened?
Well, what happened was it's just a lot of time and effort to go into card games and stuff like that. And if you don't know what you're doing, it becomes especially hard. Like, there's so much that we learned just in the first year that was like, oops, we should have done it this way. Or oops. You know, oh well. And then... once I hit university, it's just like I don't have
you don't
time,
have time.
To deal with it. And I think that one of the big things about, you know, starting a game company is you don't want to quit your day job until you can afford to.
Yeah.
So
right now it's school first and then games the secondary part.
Yeah, exactly.
So you've been working on this for approximately 6-7 years.
Yeah.
And it's finally been released. Have you looked at the process of finding other people to help co-produce the product for you since you do not have enough time to do it by yourself?
Well, what we're doing is my dad's helping out with a lot of the stuff that I can't do myself. And as well, it's been really great to partner with Mindstorm Labs. They have a lot of, you know, already established contacts in the gaming industry.
Yes,
so
Mindstorm Labs is a wonderful country.
yeah, they're really great. And so they've partnered with us to help get the product.
Are they going to help distribute it in the United States?
Well, we're going to go through their distributors.
Okay.
So we're going to be packaged with the Mindstorm Labs product.
Excellent.
As well. So
have you had any problems actually getting the United States distribution for the game?
We're kind of still working on that at this point.
So has there been any roadblocks or anything so far, or has it been fairly a smooth process so far?
I can't really say because we haven't
You're not finished yet.
Yeah, we're
okay.
still kind
of
working
on
that. On
the basis of non-disclosure agreement. Okay. Sorry about that.
Yeah, no, it's fine.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you for your time, sir.
Okay, no problem.
It's been a pleasure. I really like your card game. That's why the reason I bought one.
Yeah.
And anybody out there that's listening to this, if you want an interesting card game that has to do with space warfare, that is quick and fast-paced, go to the website, which is Corvion.
Corvion.
K-O-R-V-I-O-N.
Yeah.
And check out the game. It should be up for order, available for order online.
Soon, hopefully.
Soon. check it out. It's definitely worth the $25. This is Nathan coming from you from Gen Con for Gamers Haven Podcast. Have a wonderful day.
Nathan managed to corner Christopher Clark from Inner City Game Designs at Gen Con this year and talk to him a bit about their upcoming releases and what they had at the show. It's about a 15-minute interview, so sit back and enjoy.
This is Nathan from Gamers Haven Podcast, and I am currently talking to... I'm sorry.
Christopher Clark.
Christopher Clark of the Inner City Game Design.
That would be me.
Comprises of several products, including the Fuzzy Heroes games and the War Pigs games, as well as the Legendary Adventure System for those of you out there who have played it.
Well, and actually, that's only for another 4 weeks. Because those licenses are being retracted, so we do still have it, but get it while it's here, because it's going away. Oh, and I guess I'm in this new Up Dyson Pen book that's out under Flying Pen Productions and Cloven Fruit Enterprise Games.
Which is being sold through Iron Crown Enterprises right at the moment, correct?
No.
Just at the Gen Con show.
But, if you need to find it online, I think it's Flying Pen, right? Flying Pen Press. And it's actually an anthology of a bunch of us that have been in gaming, 3 days longer than Mutt, including Rick Loomis, myself, Mr. Gary Gygax, God rest his soul. Good Lord. There's about 14 different folks who I've known at least for 20 years, but they rooted us all up and they said, we know you guys write games. Do you write stories too? Because we'd like to put out a book in honor of Gary, and so they did. And it's a pretty neat little book. It is mostly science fiction. There's a little flavoring of sci fantasy in there. And I'm a little nervous about it because I'm a game designer. I've never been really a published author other than articles before. So.
Yeah, Gary had written several books before, including The Anubis Murders, correct?
Correct. And he's actually very well known for the Gore the Rogue series, which I frankly personally have enjoyed. But that was a series of, I want to say, 7 books that he wrote. I believe there's one more that might come out under Simon & Schuster, one final Gore the Rogue book as well.
Okay. I actually have not heard of that series. Is that a newer series?
No, that came out, not knowing your history in gaming, when the Forgotten Realms was hot and heavy and big news. Gore the Rogue premiered during that time and was, I believe, originally put out by Simon & Schuster. That was one of the big inroads that gaming made to mass market, was the Gore the Rogue series was picked up by what you would call world-class publishers.
The Forgotten Realms became popular in 1984, wasn't it?
Correct, mid-80s, and actually maybe even as early as 83. I think the first Gore the Rogue book was published in 82 or 83.
Okay, so I haven't actually had a chance to read that. Is there a place where that book can actually be purchased?
I don't think so. The Gore the Rogue novels are one of those eBay items that you find going for $40. If we were at my house, I'd look through and see if I had spare copies for you, but they're getting hard to come by.
So can you tell us a little bit about the different products that you actually have for sale?
Oh, wow. Everybody that knows me, of course, knows we do Fuzzy Heroes, but people who don't. Fuzzy Heroes was the original game of tactical combat for stuffed animals and toys, and was written because it was at the height of Games Workshop popularity, where if you really wanted to play a pretty cool miniatures game, which, by the way, I do think the Warhammer series is, you had to pay $4,000 or $5,000. And parents were coming to me saying, I'd love to get my kids gaming the way I do, but I don't have an extra $4,000 or $5,000 for them. It would be really neat if we had a miniatures game that would use miniatures we already had. So we made a toy game. It originally started its life as a game called Puppy Pounders. The minute I saw parents wanting to play with their kids, we decided that Puppy Pounders might be a little violent. So we changed it to Fuzzy Heroes, and actually it's a game now where nothing dies. It falls asleep if it takes too much damage, and if you put it in a toy box, it can come back and fight another day. We've done 5 additional books in the series for that, 2 of which are standalone. You can play as like miniature games with vehicles. We did a superheroes book, a spies book, an undead book, and the 2 standalones are a space book called Heroes in Space, and of course Plastic Ships and Fuzzy Men for Age of Sail combat with whatever toys you happen to make out of milk cartons. We did a couple other fuzzy games because I'm kind of known as being a stuffed toy game guy. We did one called DLC, which is giant stuffed toy attacks your city as a Godzilla-like creature that you defend with whatever miniatures you happen to have lying around in the box. And then we did a football game, which for some reason is popular in England but not so much here, called Sports Fuzz. But the thing most people don't realize, the last issue with the last one of those books in the series written was actually Plastic Ships and Fuzzy Men. All of them since 1996 have been reprints. These are not actually new products. They have been around for a long time. And in the last 10 years, we've pretty much been doing the microgame series. And the microgame series is, there are 3 basic divisions. There are ready-to-play board games. Those include things like Gigantic, Who's Your Daddy, Lemmings in Space. The most recent one, of course, is Exploring the Depths of Uranus. And the War Pigs line, which are miniatures games that use war with pee, plastic, infantry, guys, pigs. The third one are not really games. I also write under a moniker, Hugh Betcha. And if you see Hugh Betcha on any of our microgames, that's not really a game. It's a lot of fun to read, but if you have to touch dice, I'll be really surprised. Most of those are just sarcastic little things we put out there. Those include, like, my first miniatures game, my first LARP, things of that nature.
Can you tell us a little bit about the War Pigs game and what got you into actually creating a game with Plastic Infantry Guys?
You know, as we got into the entirety of let's make stuff anybody can afford. At that time in the market, that was 1998, and the market was just shifting to where a fantasy role-playing rulebook was $30. Before that, they were $19.95.
Yeah,
you know.
I remember that shift. It was painful.
Yes. You couldn't get more than, like, a miniature for under $10. And I said, you remember when, and I'm going to give credit where credit's due, Steve Jackson and others of his ilk had the micro games out, like Ogre, GEV, Ribbit, the creature that ate Sheboygan. There were all these cool little micro games. And I said, nobody does that anymore. We should be the people that do that again. And with full credit to Steve Jackson for having come up at least with the marketing concept of a baggy game. And so we decided that War Pigs was going to be what would catch us through cash flow for Gen Con 1998 so that we could go into another Fuzzy Hero book, which was supposed to, by the way, be called the F-Files. We never actually went that route, and we are working on a second edition. But was supposed to generate the War Chest cash for the F-Files Fuzzy Heroes book. And so we ran off 150 of them for Gen Con that year. And by Saturday, they were gone. And we have never stopped selling. War Pigs right now is approaching 11,000 units sold in the market. And generally speaking, my distributors have more of them in stock than I do. They just sell that well. I figured if they're selling that well, let's keep making micro games. And frankly, we're now up to 25 micro games in the market. And as fast as we can put out the new ones, they do sell.
Excellent. So it looks like you have various different types. It looks like there's ones with Wild West figures, some with...
We have dinosaurs, Wild West figures, bugs, jungle creatures, bugs versus plastic infantry guys, for those of you who are
fans of
Starship Trooper fans. I'm working on medievals right now for medieval war pigs, and we're also going to do both ancients and revolutionary war pigs. We have civil war pigs out. I believe there's five in the set right now, and I know it sounds funny, but I have a hard time keeping track because, seriously, the faster we write them, people want more. We are also planning on doing a Pigs Compendium when I've written what I feel is the last genre book for it, so that you can get all of them in one volume, but I won't kid you, that'll probably be about a $25 book instead of a $6 game.
Now, the Exploring the Depths of Ranuranus looks like it actually comes with figures.
It does. 24 plastic figures, and as much as that's a really funny game and people think, wow, that's got to be a really good joke game, there's a solid game in there. That's an actual tear your hair out strategy, tactical conflict, planning, and logistics management game about exploring the planet Uranus for, and you do have to suspend disbelief a little bit because it's not just a frozen rock. There are, you know, strange ores you can find and aliens to encounter and artifacts.
We won't know if any of that actually exists until we get there.
That's true. So I can get away with it for now at least.
Yes. Yeah. It's like Mars was considered inhabited and had life on it up until 1940-something when they actually got the first, no, 1960-something when they got the first pictures back.
The real pictures.
Yeah, the real pictures.
Where
the
they
Vikings.
Could see things moving and whatnot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they realized, oh, well, yeah, it's dead.
We make sure all of our games, like, again, unless it says Hugh Butchin, all of the games have what we like to call replay value. In other words, yeah, you know what, the cover is hilarious to look at. This has got to be funny. Maybe I'll just buy one to read one. There's a solid game in there. If there isn't a solid game in there, it doesn't see production. I've written a few of those, so don't get me wrong. But they go in something, in a big filing cabinet at home we like to call the vault, so that they can be improved later if they're ever going to see production. Probably the most intense strategy game I've ever written, and you're going to die, is Who's Your Daddy?
Really?
It's actually a model of a closed economic system because there is no input of energy to the system. You get your money from other players. And if you aren't thinking far enough ahead to say, well, if I take money from him, he's going to go out, and if he's my main source of income, I'm in trouble, then you wind up out of the game soon. It's actually a very, very intense game.
So do you actually have a copy of Who's Your Daddy here?
Actually, he's buying one, but let's see.
No, he just brought one up. I got to reset.
They're a simple game. We almost got Norton. I'll come back. They almost got nominated for an Origins Award on it, but they decided it was a little bit too risque on the title to be included in the Origins Award.
So a name got you disqualified.
Well, that's all right. I understand. It's an edgy product. Look at it. You know, in fact, it probably has one of the funniest cautionary warnings on the label you'll see in the industry.
A reasonably tasteless game.
Yes. which many find offensive or at least extremely tasteless. Not recommended for players under 16 years of age or those of a litigious nature. Yeah.
That's a good warning.
But it truly is a very intense game. And although all of these that appear to be maybe a little bit on the edge of say, rated R, are actually written G, they don't always play G. I will say that.
If it's being played by my gaming group, it's not G.
I can't control what happens during the game. I can only control how I wrote it. And mere coincidence that the planet Uranus on the cover looks like a butt. Because it's not about butts.
Well,
you know, it's funny.
It's actually just the way the actual copy of the black and white copy came off from probably the design
exactly,
of the original planet.
Exactly. We had no intention of making it look like that at all.
The cracks.
Yeah. No, you know, it's funny. I started in gaming writing serious articles, quick dungeon adventures for Dragon Magazine. And I looked at that and I said, well, you know, from a personal perspective, I'm not bad at this. There's guys who are better. There's Ed Greenwoods out there. There are, you know, Tim Casks out there. Why don't I find something that I'm better at than other people? And frankly, humor is my niche. And it doesn't mean the games are funny and there's not much substance here. But I also found that if you call a game something like Exploring Depths of Uranus, it's impossible for somebody at the game store to walk past it in the aisle and not wonder what it is.
That is actually quite true. I'm looking at that, and I'm looking at the fact that you have labeled on here the Unexplored Crater, which is right in the middle of the depth of Uranus.
Isn't that interesting? The Rift of the Winds, yeah. And it is more fun than NASA. We guarantee that.
Yeah. Photo courtesy of someone other than NASA.
And we've been doing the humor route ever since, probably at least DLC, the very large creature stuffed toy as Godzilla attacks your town. We have the only, I believe, suicide game on the market right now, Lemmings in Space. You start out with a crew of 36 lemmings. First one to kill off his entire crew wins. And again, you know, a funny idea that's going to be a shallow game, but really it's not, because the actual mechanics of the game are that you're playing a chess-like game, but in reverse. Instead of taking the other guy's pieces, you have to make sure that he takes yours. So you put your spaceship out there, make sure everybody has to shoot you. So strategic positioning, making sure that you've got, you know, the right side facing your enemy, all of that sort of thing, actually becomes very important.
Interesting. So these little mini games are actually not just quick
no,
little low
not.
Thought play games.
They're not. In fact, I want to caution folks, some of them may be not what you expect in the wrong direction. They may be a little too complex. You may take it home and say, I was hoping for something I could play in 45 minutes. Most of them aren't that game. Crouching Hamster Hidden Translation. Okay, that's about 45 minutes. I've written one or two that are short.
Okay. So what is the average price for most of these minigames?
The average price would be $7 because they run from 6 to 8. And actually,
okay,
we have more that are at $6 than we have at $8. So all of the Warpix series, I think they're really thick ones that are maybe 40 pages of rules, are $7. But all of the rest are $6.
Okay.
Because, you know, you ought to be able to walk into a game store with a $10 bill and walk out with change and a new product. That's how we looked at that. I didn't like that was happening to gamers.
Yeah, it's actually one of those things that is still a problem, because what it's done is it's actually reduced the size of the market, because you can only buy so many books now.
If you can only get one really cool board game for $85, and don't get me wrong, I've seen the really cool board games they have for $85.
Depending on the Undermountain.
But they're really cool.
But it's $85.
But you know what? You're going to play that three times and want to rest from it, which means your fourth gaming Sunday that would normally be your gaming Sunday, you're going to go do something else. That's not growing our hobby. That to me says, wait a minute, I want to keep doing this for another 20 years until they throw dirt in my face. Let's do something to make sure that you don't wind up doing something else on Sunday that detracts your attention from the important gaming stuff. You know.
Yeah.
And yeah, in the $85 board games, that's not it. So, don't get me wrong, I design stuff like that, I market it to other people. I say, you know, you guys ought to produce this. This is more your style. And I do have titles under several other companies. Because if you're a game designer, it's what you do. It's not important that, oh, look what I did. You know, it's more important that you have the work and you continue to get it.
Yes. It's all about actually getting the product out there.
Correct.
Now, when it comes to the actual process of manufacturing these and getting these out,
yeah,
is there any type of loopholes that you actually have to go through that are a little bit...
We have a full in-house production. Set up, yeah. This is entirely made at our place. Believe it or not, the plastic chips and fuzzy Munzer is entirely made at our place. The only thing we send out right now are covers.
Our covers?
Now, the interesting thing is, anybody who's published will tell you, you know, it costs about $4,000 minimum to go to a printing house and have a book run. It's true. You know, $4,000 to $5,000 these days. I pay a couple $1,000 to run 5 or 6 covers because I know what my next 6 books will be. They take up 4 boxes in a closet instead of the garage. And we just print, bind, and cut the stuff as we needed it ourselves.
Really?
And we only run 60,000 cash flow a year. I get to keep more than half of that. Because
excellent.
We, you know, plus you get 100% quality control. When the book comes off the press wrong, or it binds wrong, or it trims wrong, you don't sell it. You toss it. Or you give it to the local school and say, you know what, this is readable, but it's a blem. Would you guys, you know, like this for your library? Oh, sure. You know. But you don't let the market see it, and that way you never have to worry that your client, your ultimate customer, the fan, is going to get something that isn't worth the money he paid for.
Which is a very good thing.
Well, it should be.
Well, I do want to thank you, Mr. Clark, for taking the time to talk to me here at Gen Con. This is Nathan. We're going to go ahead and sign off for the moment here for Gen Con for Gamers Haven Podcast. You all have a good con.
D&D, movies, video games, RPGs, finding it easy, just stay calm, VorpalNetwork.com.
Steve Kenson is one of the preeminent game designers of our time. He developed the Mutants and Masterminds game for Green Ronin, as well as the True 20 system. He's been in the industry for quite a while, and I got to sit down with him for a little over half an hour to talk with him about the industry and talk about what's coming up with Mutants and Masterminds and just a bit about him. So sit down and enjoy this.
This is Ethan Parker with Gamers Haven Podcast. I'm here with Steve Kenson of Green Ronin Publishing, the mastermind, if you will, behind Mutants and Masterminds.
Hey, everybody. How's it going?
I want to thank you for sitting down with me at Gen Con, of course.
My pleasure.
And, sort of break the ice, obviously. We talked about it briefly on the walk over here, but how's the con going for you guys?
It's going really well. It's been a really busy, active con. The booth has been packed. Folks are definitely picking up all of the new products, and you know, it seems to be going really well.
What is it that you guys are debuting this year at Gen Con? You've got the, I think you debuted the GM screen for Mutants and Masterminds at Origins.
Origins, that's right. And the new product for Gen Con is the Wildcard Sourcebook.
Which you announced last year at Gen Con.
Yes, exactly. And that's a 256-page hardcover campaign setting, very much in the format of our other M&M campaign settings like Freedom City and Paragons, based on the long-standing series of novels edited by George R.R. Martin about alternate history world with people with superpowers.
Right, right. And there's a new comic series going on for that now, isn't there?
There's both a new novel series that just started with the book Inside Straight, as well as a new comic book series from Dabble Brothers called The Hard Call.
Okay, excellent, excellent. Obviously, the big thing right now, then, is the wild cards. And you guys are working on the Song of Fire and Ice for just general Green Ronin stuff, but the wild cards, what do you guys have in the pipeline on that?
Well, the next thing's coming up for wild cards...
That you can talk about, I should say.
The next thing's coming up for wild cards is we have an adventure anthology called All In, which is a set of 4 wild cards adventures that take place in various locales and aspect various parts of the setting that are all designed to be ready to play for a game master to drop right into a wild cards game or to use it to get a wild cards game going. After that, we got a source book in the works called Aces and Jokers. That's going to be pretty much what we've been calling the Everybody Else in the Wild Cards Universe source book.
Sure.
The Wild Cards campaign setting book has about 80 or so characters in it. And that's definitely the bulk of the meatiest chapter in the book, is detailing all of the major characters of the Wild Cards universe. Aces and Jokers is going to detail probably about twice that many of the minor characters in the series, characters who are lesser known, haven't appeared as often, or that don't have as much known about them,
right.
So that they don't rate quite the full size biographies that we did in the campaign setting book, but we'll still provide all the information there is about them.
But obviously, there's more to Mutants and Masterminds than just Wild Cards.
Mm-hmm.
You have the first setting for it was obviously your Freedom City.
Right.
What can you tell us about some of the history of Freedom City and where maybe Freedom City is going?
Well, Freedom City started out as a project of mine that I designed for another publisher, actually, that was looking for a superhero campaign setting. And that publication deal didn't work out.
Sure.
The rights for the project reverted to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I held on to it for a while and worked on it in my spare time and just sort of tinkered with it for fun. And at the time, this was before Mutants and Masterminds was published, there weren't really any superhero games on the market, so there really weren't any publishers for me to pitch the setting to. Champions had been fallow at that time for a while, and there weren't any other actively published superhero games. So I had been talking to Chris Kramus, who was the president of Green Ronin and was a friend of mine. And I mentioned that I had this cool superhero setting, but there was nothing I could do with it because there was no place to publish it.
Mm-hmm.
And Chris said, oh, well, let me take a look at it. And so I sent him a copy, and he read it. And he said, well, I'll tell you what. If you'd be interested in designing a superhero game based on the open game license, based on the D20 system reference document,
mm-hmm.
we'll set up a two-book deal, and we'll do a game book, and we'll do your setting book.
Right.
And, you know, if it works out, you know, maybe we'll do some more stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, okay, well, you know, I was honestly a little dubious about designing a D20-based superhero game, but, you know, I was like, I really want to get my setting published, so I'll give it a try.
Oh, yeah.
And so I designed Mutants and Masterminds. We did Freedom City First Edition as the first source book.
Mm-hmm.
And when we revised Mutants and Masterminds for the second edition, we likewise brought Freedom City up to date, incorporated all of the new Freedom City material we had done through the course of First Edition into the campaign setting book and released a second edition Freedom City book. And it's been the sort of default four-color setting for Mutants and Masterminds since then.
The sort of throwback to the old Silver Age stuff. And it sounds like you've worked on that setting for many, many, many years.
Quite a few years, yeah.
And you do a great job in it of hitting on those key elements of modern and Silver Age style uh-huh. of a game. Did you do that? I'm assuming you did that consciously.
Obviously.
But what were your sources of inspiration for the direction you went with Freedom City?
Well, Freedom City is in many ways sort of in the style a lot of people call sort of the retro style of comics,
right.
the neo Silver Age style mm-hmm. of comics. That is in some ways written as sort of a very self-conscious reflection on the history of comics,
right.
From the Golden Age to the present.
Because mm-hmm. You also, not just looking at the main book and the Freedom City book itself, is there are essays in the main book, isn't it, that talk about the different ages of
comics? Yeah.
And then you guys obviously did Golden Age and Iron Age and all those.
Yep.
It's obviously a passion with you and with the other people who are involved with Mutants and Masterminds. Really, how how did it come about that you guys went to, like, comic book artists to do the art for the books? I mean, it seems like a no-brainer now.
Well, yeah, I guess that's how it seemed to us, too, was, you know, I mean, if you're going to do art for a comic book game, why not go to the people who do it for a living and mm-hmm. know what they're doing?
Right, right.
You know, I mean, certainly there are plenty of comic book artists who are out of our price scale, and who, you know, we'd love to work with, but we can't afford to. There are also plenty of, you know, talented comic book artists, you know, who we were able to work with, and plenty of artists in the RPG industry, because there's a lot of crossover between the comics and RPG fields in terms of art. So we've worked with a lot of artists who have since gone on to do comics in one fashion or another.
Sure. So I know you guys have worked with Udon quite a bit.
Yep, we've done quite a bit of work with Udon.
I first remember them from Deadpool series, quite honestly. Yeah. You know, that's about all I can think of off the top of my head.
Udon has turned out some of our best Eminem covers. They did the awesome cover to Mastermind's Manual, which I'm a big fan of. Which is the picture of Overshadow.
I was
his command.
I was heartbroken that didn't get in any nomination last year.
Yeah.
It's like,
I think it really deserved one for Udon.
We do an Ennie show every year and about Ennie's nominees, and we specifically mentioned that. It's like, why didn't this get nominated? But we won't talk about this year's Ennies because only Hero High got nominated this year.
Yeah.
Rightfully so. Hero High is a great game.
Yeah, Hero High is an awesome book. Lucien Solbaum, the author, did a fantastic job with it.
Are you guys planning on expanding on that at all, the Hero High?
Not as such. Hero High is a pretty complete book in and of itself. I think that if there is any expansion on it as such, it'll probably be more in the form of we might do a Teen Heroes-style adventure.
Right.
Or possibly some further expansion of the Claremont Academy setting
for
Freedom City. Although Hero High does a pretty good job of fleshing that out and providing a lot of detail.
Okay. With Freedom City and with Mutants and Masterminds in general probably being, if not the best superheroes game that's out there right now, or at least that's the general consensus.
Mm-hmm.
What is directly in the pipe coming out soon? Because I know you guys were talking about doing a more of a sword and sorcery style and a mecha style, manga style.
Well, on the more traditional Freedom City side of things, we've got a book called Freedom's Most Wanted that's in production right now. And
that should come out relatively soon, shouldn't
that'll
it?
That'll probably be in the fall, yeah.
Fall, excellent.
Freedom's Most Wanted is a collection of villain characters for the Freedom City setting, but they're designed a little bit differently than we've done with some past Freedom City material, in that a lot of the characters in Most Wanted have less clear ties to some of the existing Freedom City characters.
Sure.
So they're not designed as somebody's nemesis or the like, or somebody's regular sparring partner. And so they're designed to be a little bit more free-floating and a little bit easier to drop into your own game to use as the villains for your player characters.
Sure. So with Freedom's Most Wanted and with the Freedom City second edition that came out a while back, are you progressing the story of the setting?
Well, we decided really pretty early on that the setting doesn't have a story.
Okay.
There's no ongoing overarching
plot
in Freedom City.
Okay.
Freedom City is very much sort of a snapshot of a particular setting, comic book universe. And it's really, the story is really up to what it is the game master and the players want to take it. So we really try to avoid making, as much as possible, making the Freedom City setting about the adventures of the Freedom League or the Adam family or any of the characters we introduced in the books, because we don't want Mutants and Masterminds to be about that. We want it to be about the adventures of everybody's own hero group that they make up.
Sure. Well, what's beyond Foes of Freedom?
So after Foes of Freedom, we do get into some alternate, different ground for Mutants and Masterminds.
Sure. You obviously don't just focus on Freedom City. There's
right,
other things.
Right. And so we've been doing source books on a variety of different genres of comics. We've done Golden Age and Iron Age.
And we've got a source book coming up called Mecha and Manga, which is going to be source book focused on Japanese manga comics and anime-style games. And so it's taking a really completely different style of comic that encompasses a whole lot of other genres.
Sure.
And looking at how to use mutants and masterminds with that.
Okay.
And that's going to encompass all the various genres, and especially the sort of specialized, unique genres and subgenres that you find in manga that you don't see in Western comics.
Right.
And how to use those. And it's going to come with its own campaign setting that basically takes all of the...
Like its own campaign setting in the book, or it will be a separate?
The last chapter of the book is going to present a campaign setting that is going to take all the conceits of the manga comics and show a worked example of, here's a setting that uses all of them, so that you can have, you know, giant mecha and psychic girls and people with pet monsters all fighting it out.
And the inevitable, big mecha showing up in Freedom City or something like that.
Yeah, and there's definitely going to be some notes on how it is you can do crossover and how you can connect these genres.
I'm thinking, the Teen Titans Tokyo crossover they did.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And one of the ideas the book suggests is you can easily do a setting where, Freedom City exists in the Western world.
Right.
Japan in the Freedom City universe is this wild, wacky manga anime place where all this stuff is going on.
Sure.
After that, we've got a similar genre source book called Warriors and Warlocks that is basically a look at the sword and sorcery genre of comic books.
Sure.
So books like Warlord and Arion, Lord of Atlantis, and Savage Sword of Conan, and those sorts of things. And a lot of people are like, it's fantasy M&M, and this sort of is,
right.
But it's really still looked at very much from the sword and sorcery comic book lens. So there's a lot of discussion about, why don't barbarians wear armor?
Sure.
And the sort of ideas that you're going to find more commonly in, the Barry Windsor-Smith and Roy Thomas Conan stories, than you're going to find, say, in, J.R.R. Tolkien.
It seems like that one's going to be a lot more difficult to emulate as far as people bringing contrast with that in, say, D&D or anything like that, or True 20.
Yeah, I mean, obviously when you do any fantasy-style game, all fantasy role-playing games get compared to D&D because D&D is the yardstick that they're all measured by.
Right.
And because Mutants and Masterminds is derived from the D20 system, there are obvious similarities. But I think that in some regards that works in our favor, because people who are going to play a sword and sorcery style game with Mutants and Masterminds are going to find a lot of D&D flavor to it, because you've got the 6 ability scores and
especially with 4th edition just coming out and everything.
Right. So. And so that's going to have a very similar history of sword and sorcery comics, a look at how to adapt the various genre tropes to M&M, and a worked example using our Freeport City of Adventure setting as a sword and sorcery setting for Mutants and Masterminds.
Because you mentioned Freeport in Worlds of Freedom, I think.
Freeport is a short section in Worlds of Freedom, and that actually dates all the way back to the first edition of Freedom City, where Freeport is mentioned as an alternate world that people from the Freedom City universe have visited before.
Right.
So we've long established connections between the two settings, and this is going to bring that out in more detail.
Okay. Is there anything beyond that that we can expect that can be talked about at least?
Well, we're talking about projects for next year, and nothing is etched in stone at this point. But it's pretty safe to say that we're going to do a Silver Age source book.
Okay. Enough people have asked for that now?
A lot of people have asked for it, and we've honestly been planning to do it ever since we started covering the various genres. And it'll round out the Golden Age and Iron Age source books and complete the trifecta of the major ages of comics. I'd very much like to do a supervillain source book
year. That'd be great.
That's tentatively called the Supervillains Handbook.
Okay.
That'll basically be a big book on how to to create villains, how to run them, a lot of archetypes and tools that game masters can use to create their own villains, create their own villainous headquarters and schemes, and you know, a lot of what I'm currently calling plot archetypes, which are basically just, you know, a variety of villainous schemes that you can mix and match to, you know, create your own games. So, you know, the top 10 ways to destroy the world, you know, and those sorts of things.
Okay, excellent. Last note on Mutes and Masterminds is the data set for Hero Lab just came out. And it seems like you guys are working very much, very closely with them, with Lone Wolf Studios, I think is their name, to basically keep that thing up to date and accurate and everything. What are your feelings on that?
Oh, Hero Lab is fantastic. The guys at Lone Wolf have done an awesome job adapting their character design engine for Mutants and Masterminds. It's, you know, hugely convenient. I mean, it's a very, very useful system where all the data you need on character creation is there in the system, and you can just literally create characters by just clicking on the interface. So you click to add abilities, you click to add powers, it does all the math for you. If you change anything, all of the cascading stuff, like changes to saving throws and grapple modifiers and all the little tiny things, all that stuff gets automatically changed for you. You know, it has a setup where it'll give you warnings if you bump things above power level limits.
Right.
So I mean, it's just a tremendously useful character design tool. And the Lone Wolf guys have been really, really responsive to folks on our forums, on their own forums, in terms of feedback, in terms of bug fixes and updates. And they've just been fantastic.
I think they've updated it twice since it released already. During the process of them basically developing the data set for that, were there any major landmark changes that they were asking for, or you guys were asking for? I mean, how did that really go?
Well, basically, the Hero Lab engine was originally designed for D20,
right?
So that gave some advantage to the Lone Wolf guys when they were getting started, because that's basically what Mutants and Masterminds is based on. We provided them with all of the core rules information.
Right.
They basically went through the process of adapting it and coding it so that it was all included in their database. And then adding the various subsystems to handle M&M's unique aspects, like the power level limits and the toughness save and the like. And they basically just built a new interface for the Mutants and Masterminds data set, imported all of the data that they had put together to make it run. And they've done a really awesome job.
Fantastic, fantastic. Moving away from Mutants and Masterminds, much as I love it, you are also the head of the True 20 line as well. Obviously, True 20 has been around now for when did it come out? So was it 2 years ago?
True 20 has been around now for what? About 3 years.
2 or 3 years,
And True 20, the latest True 20 product was the Adepts Handbook.
Okay.
Which is the second of our three role handbooks that's expanding the three main character roles. Adept's Handbook has gotten great reviews. It provides all sorts of information on new powers and how to customize the powers and adept characters in the game to suit the type of game you want to run, from magician types in fantasy to psychics to super beings to even gadgeteers and just really sort of clever intellectual characters who have, you know, tricks that are the equivalent of powers. You can do the whole range of it with Adept's Handbook. It's been a really great book for the line.
And obviously we can expect the other two roles to come out.
The Expert's Handbook is already out, and the Warrior's Handbook will be following the heels of the Adept's Handbook. And basically take the same approach of providing a lot more detailed options for combat and fighting characters in the game.
Sure. And I did want to touch on real quick Green Ronin. I always say Green Ronin, but I'm Midwest. That's all I can do. Has announced that the only remotely GSL product they're going to be putting out is going to be the character folio, I think.
That's the only plan we have at the moment.
Right. And I was curious how 4th edition sort of impacted with your plans or really with your plans for True 20.
Not at all.
Not at all?
Because True 20 and Mutants and Masterminds are both published under the Open Game License.
Right.
And the open game license is perpetual.
Sure.
We didn't have any concerns regarding the further publication of those games. We were curious to see, you know, where things would go with 4th edition, obviously,
sure.
and the GSL. And we had made, you know, a variety of sort of tentative plans of, well, you know, if it looks like this, we might do this. And had sort of a wait-and-see attitude.
Sure.
We found the GSL too restrictive for our purposes.
Sure.
And so we just decided that it wasn't worth our while to get back into doing products to support D&D.
So really all the fans of True 20 out there don't have to worry about it just suddenly disappearing.
No.
Okay.
No. True 20 is not going anywhere. And honestly, you know, if there's been any impact on our sales or interest in our product from 4th edition, it's been positive, if anything.
Sure.
So we really haven't seen any negative impact.
Excellent, excellent. Well, speaking from the point of view of with Green Ronin, when they first started out, they were a D20 D&D publisher, obviously.
Yep.
And to where they're at now, where you've got your own you know settings, your own systems going on. With the Legend of Fire and Ice coming out, it's its own system. It's not D20. It's not. Correct me if I'm wrong. Of course, it's not OGL.
No, it is not.
It's not OGL.
No.
What are your feelings on where the company's come from and where they're going? Really, I mean, how it's progressed.
Well, Green Ronin has you know always been willing, in my experience, to take risks and do things a little differently.
Mm-hmm.
We were one of the first. We were one of the first companies to take advantage of the D20 license to begin
sure.
with, publishing one of the first D&D adventures that went on sale the same day as the 3rd edition Player's Handbook.
Right.
We were.
I remember that. I was here. That was Milwaukee, but I remember that.
We were one of the first companies that published an entirely open game license product with Mutants and Masterminds.
Really? Okay. That's fascinating.
We were, you know, one of the first companies that published an entirely standalone class and level based system with True 20.
Mm-hmm.
So Green Ronin has always been willing to take the next step and to
sure.
do something a little different. And I think that that is something that, you know, our fans have responded to. And, you know, we've occasionally had, you know, some projects that haven't worked out.
Sure.
But generally speaking, you know, when we're willing to take some risks, things seem to prove themselves out pretty well.
Excellent, excellent. And obviously, there's a good correlation between True 20 and Mutants and Masterminds.
Sure.
I mean, obviously, True 20 came out afterwards, and it uses the same toughness save system.
Mm-hmm.
I just talking system wise, I wanted to know where were you coming from when you thought of that the toughness save idea.
The toughness save idea.
Yeah.
Basically, when I first started designing Mutants and Masterminds, I took the D20 system resource document, sort of stripped it down,
sure.
looked at the really core elements of it to get a feel for how it worked, and you know started tinkering with various ideas and said, okay, if I'm going to do a superhero game, what are the things I'm going to need? And the first real issue I ran up against was how to handle damage in the game because of the nature of hit points in then 3rd edition D&D. it seemed likely that superhero scale characters were going to have huge numbers of hit points,
sure,
and, you know, large numbers of damage dice. That depending on however you determine damage, there are going to be a lot of them.
Right.
And that, you know, characters rolling 15 or 20 d6
right,
to do damage was not at all unlikely.
Yeah, before Mutants and Masterminds, I can't think of any game system that didn't have, you know, gobs of dice that you needed for a superhero game. So,
So while there certainly is a, you know, a certain visceral joy to, you know,
picking up the
30 d6 and rolling them.
All Star Wars d6 players know that feeling, yes.
In my experience, it's still, generally speaking, slows down play, especially when you
sure
have to roll 30 d6 and then add them.
Yeah.
And I wanted the Mutants and Masterminds game to be fairly fast-paced.
Sure.
So I was concerned that hit points and huge numbers of damage dice were going to slow the game down too much. So I looked at other ways to do damage in the game. And, you know, there were ideas about scaling the dice so that you would roll fewer of them and multiply them or things like that. But they came off as kind of kludgy and...
Sure.
So I looked at how the D20 engine handled pretty much every other hazard in the game,
mm-hmm,
like poison and traps and the like.
Sure.
And I said, well, pretty much everything other than damage is a saving throw.
Mm-hmm.
If your character gets poisoned, you know, it's a saving throw. If your character falls under somebody's mind control, it's a saving throw. So I said, well, why can't damage be the same way? So I roughed out the initial design of what became the toughness save system, and I pitched it to Chris at Viranine, and he thought it was a good idea. The key element, the difficulty with the toughness save system wasn't so much the system itself; it was the fact that it meant that we were going to have to go with the open game license rather than the D20 license for
sure
Mutants and Masterminds.
So when you guys were first developing Mutants and Masterminds, it was more of a D20 license product.
Originally, the plan was to make it a D20 license product because that's what everybody was doing.
Oh, right, yeah.
You know, the common wisdom in the industry was that the D20 license was where all the value was.
Sure.
And the open game license was just a sentence of certain death,
sure,
to a product.
And you look now, obviously.
Yeah,
you know,
indeed. And so, you know, we realized that that was going to be the trade-off, was if we were going to go with this mechanic, we would have to use the open game license because the restrictions of the D20 license were such that we couldn't introduce a new damage mechanic like that.
Sure.
And so we talked it over and we decided that ultimately it was more important to produce as good a game as we could.
Right.
And, you know, we would worry about the marketing later.
Mm-hmm.
So we ultimately went with the open game license, and I think that rightly so, because I think it made Mutants and Masterminds a better game, and, you know, it seems like it's marketing itself pretty well.
Sure. And it's a fantastic game.
Thank you.
Definitely my group's favorite. You know, we just finished up a 5 or 6 session Freedom City game, so... along those same lines, where were you coming from when you took that and molded it into what became 220?
Well, 220 originally arose out of the game system that was designed for the Blue Rose game.
Okay.
And Blue Rose was...
And it was the romantic fantasy,
yes,
correct?
Yes, okay. It's the subtitle is a role-playing game of romantic fantasy. And Blue Rose was an attempt to look at another genre of fantasy that hadn't really seen much investigation in RPG product.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that we wanted to go with Blue Rose was a simpler D20-based game system that wasn't quite as detailed and fiddly and tactical as 3rd edition D&D was.
Mm-hmm.
That was a little more user-friendly, was a little simpler, and didn't involve... was a little more tailored to the setting.
Right.
So, Blue Rose was another example of a product that started out as a D20 licensed product and evolved into an OGL product.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the demands of the design.
Right.
And So when I was doing the design for Blue Rose, one of the things I was looking to simplify was combat. And so I looked at what had already been done in Mutants and Masterminds for that. And so importing the toughness save from Mutants and Masterminds seemed a natural consequence. And a lot of folks mentioned that it had the interesting effect of making it so that characters, regardless of their level, were still relatively threatened in combat.
Right.
And it lessened the element that higher level characters had large number of hit points that made lower level threats less relevant.
Mm-hmm.
And that seemed to sort of smooth out the power progression in the game somewhat, which lent itself pretty well to the game overall. And so when we saw that there was a lot of interest in the actual game system of Blue Rose, separate from the setting itself,
Sure. We
realized that it had some potential on its own, and decided that we would produce it as a standalone game system without a setting attached to it. And that was where we came up with 220.
And 220 has been very successful for you guys.
And 220 has done quite well in that fashion.
That is
a standalone game system. So.
That's fantastic. I know I personally can't wait to see what Green Ronin has coming out. You guys do quality product, so.
Thanks very much. We've got some exciting stuff in the works, so we're looking forward to it.
Well, I wanted to thank you for sitting down with me here and taking some time out at Gen Con.
My pleasure.
And telling me about what's going on with Green Ronin and what's going on meeting some masterminds. So thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Thanks for your time.
Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt our program of dance music to bring you a special bulletin from the Intercontinental Radio News.
ChattyDM.net is a blog run by Philippe Antoine Menard, a French-Canadian gamer who likes to talk about D&D, tropes, coolness in RPGs, his current campaign, his geeky thoughts, and his poking at the crunch and fluff of his favorite RPGs. He also posts his opinions and rants about the state of his current favorite RPG, Dungeons & Dragons. It's his wish to build a community of bloggers and readers that can share varied thoughts and opinions about our favorite hobby while maintaining a civil and cordial environment. The Chatty DM can be reached at www.chattydm.net or by email at chattydm@chattydm.net.
I got a chance to sit down with Dave Carter and Earl Fisher from Mindstorm Labs. They're the developers of the Alpha Omega role-playing game. Got to sit down with them at Gen Con and have a bit of an interview with them, talking about their upcoming releases, talking about their marketing that they did for Alpha Omega. It's about a 21-minute interview, so sit down and enjoy.
Alrighty. This is Ethan with Gamers Haven Podcast. I'm here with Dave Carter and Earl Fisher.
Yep, you got it.
Excellent. With Mindstorm Labs, creators of the Alpha Omega game, which you reviewed in some episode I can't remember the number of. But why don't we start off, just break the ice. Already asked it, but how's the con treating you guys?
Really good.
Yeah, really well. The response to the game has been awesome, you know, and people are really digging it, trying out the demos at the booth, and we've had a few game sessions on the go. We've run full adventures. People are really, really enjoying the game.
Excellent, excellent. And you guys were nominated for several Ennies. Did you actually walk away with any last night?
No, we did not.
What do they do?
Well, the nomination is really the win, because
Yes. We're,
you know, first time around, so just getting nominated is really what it's all about.
I tried to walk away with one, but security grabbed me.
Stopped them.
That happens sometimes, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Well, obviously, Alpha Omega came out several months ago, and full-color, hardback, landscape-style book. So you guys decided to sort of go off on a tangent on at least the format of the book. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. It's widescreen.
Got
the book is laid out that way for a couple of different reasons. The
The first reason is that we wanted to do something different. We like the idea of a book that spreads out wide like that.
Mm-hmm.
The most important reason is that the book visually is really stunning. We've got incredible artwork, full-page artwork that spans both pages. Mm-hmm. And so when you lay it out...
And it's a full bleed, too, right?
Yeah, it goes right out to all the edges. Every inch of the page is covered.
Yeah.
And so that's really the big thing. And one of the more functional elements, there are lots of charts and stuff to reference, and like some of the weapons pages, for example, when you lay it out, you can see, 8 or 10 columns across a page or a set of 2 pages.
Right.
Makes it really easy to kind of go back and forth.
So to set it out on the pages you need during the game and whatnot. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, real quick, for those of our listeners that might not be familiar with Alpha Omega, give us sort of a rundown of what the game is.
Sure, I can give you a con spiel. It's a game that takes place in a futuristic Earth in what we kind of refer to as post-apocalyptic. So it's about 200 years after the apocalypse. The majority of the cities that are still standing have gotten back on their feet, and they're now trying to reinitiate trade and communications, try to get the global economy going very slowly. In between those cities, Mother Nature has really reclaimed most of the Earth, and it's quite dangerous out there. A lot of mutagenic viruses, biological weapons, and kind of radiation is left over from the war. It's really had a serious effect on the wildlife. So a lot of really scary monsters out there. On top of that, we have 2 alien races, the Seraph and O'Phantom, who come to Earth every 10,000 years to wage a huge war. They're about to show up again, and they've been misrepresented by history as being angels and demons. In our game world, they're aliens. This will be the first time that Earth's population will be able to have a direct impact on the outcome of their war because of our technology and the advancements we've made.
Okay, and so it's is it more hard science fiction game or more science fiction space opera, or what's sort of the feel that you're going with it?
Well, I'll probably answer this one, but we set it up as a framework, so...
Yeah, the sci-fi element is... It's not space opera. It's definitely a more dark, gritty, dirty kind of cyber. Cyberpunk is not really the only way to describe it. That's one element of the game. The game world is polarized into the urban world, the arcologies, the city states,
right,
which dot the landscape, and in between them, like Dave mentioned, are the wilds. So inside the cities, we have high technology, big corporations with resources and access to resources. Resource warfare is one of the themes that runs through the game as the game kicks off. So there's all kinds of technology available there. But outside of the cities, you've got that sort of Mad Max wasteland feel where, there's what we call the free zone communities. They're not controlled by a city-state or anything like that. Technology is very low, very rudimentary. So it kind of runs the gamut. If you want to get into a game and play a slick, urban, sort of Blade Runner-esque sci-fi game, or a dark, gritty, cyberpunk feel game, you can do that in the cities. If you want to get out and just, run through the trees and fight monsters, you can do that out in the wild. So as gamers, those were kind of the two things that we love to play D&D and run around and fight monsters, but we also love games like Shadowrun and old cyberpunk and stuff like that, where you had that, technology was an important part of the game, and the feel of the urban world is an important part of the game. So we've kind of just polarized the world with our apocalyptic scenario, and then just set the stage for this coming evolutionary war with the various playable species in the game, the Nephilim, the Grigori, which are half-breeds. So, that was a long answer to a simple question.
No problem.
All right.
No problem. Going sort of on the vein of getting this game started, and when you guys first started to develop it, didn't you guys start doing some viral marketing for this game?
Yeah, we did. We launched a viral marketing campaign in June of 2007.
Yep.
A series of puzzles on a website called www.ethanhoffswasright.com.
It's a fine first name, I should say.
Nice. So, we put the website up and tried to inform a lot of different game sites about different sites that look for interesting things on the web or puzzle sites.
I remember you guys got picked up by some other news wires, like
I spotted you on I spotted that on comingsoon.net and Supergirl Hype and things like that.
Yeah, it ended up all over the place, and then once the link to Cloverfield was made, it went out of control.
Yeah. Yeah, we went from a couple of thousand hits a week to 12.5 million within a 3-4 week span.
Wow. Yeah, it ballooned very, very rapidly.
So for a marketing campaign that was supposed to slowly expose and introduce our game to the community, it instantly was put under a magnifying glass of epic proportions.
In the LA Times, Forbes, USA Today, all reported it incorrectly.
But hey, any publicity, right?
Well, yeah,
right.
Yeah. We tried, you know, we tried some in-game stuff to try and, you know, let people know that it wasn't Cloverfield. And even we read interviews later that the guys behind Cloverfield had done, where people were asking them, "What's this Ethan Hosling?" And they were like, "I don't know." And we like dropped little hints in our marketing campaign, saying, you know, this date doesn't mean anything to us, as we were, you know, without breaking character, you know. But it was too far gone, and no one
believed us.
Yeah, no one believed us.
Front company for J.J. Abrams.
Yeah. Last year at Gen Con, people actually came to the booth just to see if we were real, like, people. Uh-huh. They were like, "So, I'm pretty sure you guys are Cloverfield." And we're like, "No, we're not, man. It's a role-playing game. It's coming out next year. It's going to be great." And they're like, "Yeah, whatever. You're Cloverfield." And I'm like, "Ah." So you can, you know, you can only do what you can to win them over, but, yeah.
Excellent. Well, what went behind the idea for going that route? Because this is the first time that I know of that an RPG started doing viral marketing on and sort of embraced the web like that.
Well, we wanted to do something different in every element of the game, whether it's the layout, a new mechanic system, a new kind of fresh approach to it. And, you know, and Earl and Tom are both really intelligent guys that are up on all the new, Web 2.0 stuff, so we really wanted to come at it from a fresh approach and really grab people's attention.
Yeah, we took Ethan Haas. Ethan Haas is part of the game's mythology. He's this prophet who writes this journal, and he has these visions of the world that becomes Alpha Omega.
Right.
And so we just borrowed him as a character that we thought, you know, we can use this guy. He's sort of this enigmatic character with some kind of zany visions, and we can use these to drop clues and sort of start to pique interest. And the puzzles came from that, and the video. That as you solve the puzzles, you see are a guy named Van Mantra, and he's one of the evolutionary species in the game, and he's sort of a disciple or follower of Haas's prophetic visions, and he knows that this evolutionary war is coming. So we tried to like layer into the marketing some of the game's mythology that really sets the stage, and then it just kind of went from there. So we were just trying to do, like Dave said, something different, something that had never been done before, and really not only was it great for Alpha Omega, the exposure and the interest, but it's probably the most press that a tabletop game has had, you know, outside of D&D, of course, but, you know, I can't think of a time when a tabletop RPG got that kind of exposure, so it was really good just to see, you know, pen and paper, it's not Cloverfield, it's a pen and paper RPG,
right.
And, you know, millions of people were hitting the website who had never even heard of pen and paper games before, you know, so it was really good, really good.
Okay, well, moving on to the more core part of the game is, obviously the game is not a D20 game.
Right.
So you guys chose to go against the grain, at least somewhat at the time, you know, of people jumping on the D20 bandwagon. What was behind that? What thought process came into there to develop that?
Basically, it was pretty simple. There was no real... We wanted to create a game engine that was capable of handling all the things we wanted PCs to be able to accomplish in their turns. So... we wanted to give gameplay like a kind of a matrix bullet time feel for your characters, so as they progress, they get more and more turns within a set amount of time. Really, it was just about giving players the flexibility and a set of mechanics that was very versatile and powerful and allowed them to do things that you just simply can't do in other games. So, I mean, if you want me to go into how the mechanics work in a nutshell.
Please do.
So, essentially, it's called the 6-6 system because you always have six dice in your pool.
Okay.
That's the first six. And as your character progresses, you move from, like, D4s and D6s up to D8s, 10s, 12s, and 20s. So, in theory, you one die that would have taken you multiple dice to do previously. Because the unique thing about our system is that it's up to the player when and how they're going to spend their dice. So if you're powerful enough, you could have up to 6 turns in one combat cycle, but you only have 6 dice to spend throughout that time. So if you use all of your dice on your first turn, then you have nothing left for defense or subsequent actions. And as you become more skilled and more powerful, you can accomplish a lot of actions with just one die, so therefore giving you power across the entire movement cycle.
Speaking from, I've looked through the book. It hasn't actually made the rounds to me to actually read the full thing yet, because I have 2 co-hosts, and Nathan still has it, and he won't let it go. But the looking through the book, I know one thing some people that some of my co-hosts and some other people I've shown the book to were kind of intimidated by was the possible complexity of it. Do you have anything to say to sort of alleviate those concerns?
Oh, for sure. I mean, it's a new system, totally new. So when you first look at it, it's so different. It does take a while to get used to it. Once you start playing it, though, the core mechanics of the dice pool system is very, very simple. It can be used to resolve any situation in the game. Mm-hmm. Now, there is layers of complexity that we've added into the game, but the majority of them are optional rules. So if you enjoy tactical combat, that you want it to slow down, so you want to pay attention to whether your character's kneeling or running, and are the enemies behind cover, you can incorporate all of those rules.
But you don't have to.
You don't have to. I mean, but we kind of wanted to set the game up so that it can be used as an RPG, it can be used as a tactical miniatures combat game, just to give GMs flexibility for what their players want to use. Same with the magic system. It's kind of an open system where there's no set spells, so you create your own magic as you play the game. So there's a system in place for basically creating any magical effect you want. It's called wielding in our game, through this system. And at first glance, it takes a bit of getting used to, but once you've gone through it a couple of times, it's an incredibly powerful tool for adding just incredible options and power to your characters.
We really wanted to, the game itself, not only in terms of the complexity of the setting, but the complexity of the mechanics, we didn't want to dumb it down. We wanted to make a game that had all the options that we as experienced game players would want to have access to.
Mm-hmm.
So when you pick up the core manual, there is a ton of stuff there, but it's there because we want it. As a player, we wouldn't want to have to wait for that kind of stuff. We wouldn't want to have to wait for the next generation combat rules or, whatever. We wanted it to be the kind of game that a seasoned gamer could pick up and really enjoy the detail of, that a new player could get into and ignore all of the optional rules and learn the dice pool mechanic and then just play simply.
Right.
But the core manual has got everything. It's not dumbed down at all. And that can be interpreted as a potentially very complex game, but in reality it's as complex as you want to make it.
I know with me, I picked up the book and it really reminded me of the days before D20, when you just come to a place like Gen Con and you see all these different styles of games with, the thought never crossed your mind that, this system's compatible with that system, da-da-da-da-da.
Right.
Are you guys planning on using that system for anything else, or is Alpha Omega going to be your core at this point?
Well, right now, Alpha Omega is definitely our core. We want to support that. We're putting out our feature manual called The Encounter in the next couple of months. We've got our equipment manual in the works. So we really do. Alpha Omega is our flagship. We're going to be supporting it for a long time. But that being said, the 6-6 system is a fantastic system for a superhero game or anything where the characters can achieve epic powers.
Right.
So, it could easily be used for other games, but at the moment we don't have plans for it.
Well, you mentioned the monster book you guys are putting out. I'm sorry, what was the title for it?
The Encountered Volume 1.
The Encountered Volume 1, okay. What can you tell us about that?
The Encountered is a collection of 200 unique creatures in our game world. There's going to be rules for creature creation, encounter management. We're going to have a lot of modification templates, so you can quickly apply them to any of the existing creatures to give them kind of a different edge. The same way that we created the core rulebook as a platform to take in the direction you wanted it to, we're doing the same thing with the encounters. So we have very clear distinction between five different creature types, and so if you're running a really pristine, high-tech sci-fi, there's some creatures there you might not want to incorporate. Or if you're running cyberpunk, there's a lot of creatures that are set up to be, you know, they're half animal and half machine. So there's a lot of very distinct differences, but on the other hand, they're all there for you to use no matter what type of campaign you're running. And the production value of the creature manual is even going to blow the socks off our any nominated core rulebook.
Still in widescreen, I'm hoping?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Okay.
The artwork is out of control again. The same.
You guys have a preview of it going on.
Yeah,
correct?
We've got some sample pages. We've got the same guys who did the core rulebook.
Can we see those sample pages, any of that sample stuff online?
Yeah, there's the sample pages are on the Mindstorm Labs website. If they're not, they will be after Gen Con. But
I'll put links to them on our show notes.
Okay. It's all there. Yeah, it'll be a fantastic feature.
The art you guys have, I mean, you guys obviously went and got some really great artists to sort of get the right feel for this.
Yeah. That was super important for us. We wanted to make sure that the game visually represented itself well. We wanted to really, we're very visual people, and we wanted, it's a 404 page book, and there's a lot of text in there, and we knew that we wanted to have a good balance between, you know, textual information and visual information, and, you know, the imagery of the book. If you've just flipped through the core manual, you know what the game is about just by looking at the pictures.
Right.
You get a really good sense. You know, here's a big, vast wasteland with a crater in the middle of it, and then the next page, here's, like, you know, a big wasteland, and you can see in the background an arcology rising up out of the horizon, and, you know, guys and, you know, gunfights in the city. You know what you're getting into just by looking at the imagery. Same thing with the creature manual. When you open it up, you're going to see all of the creatures in incredible full-color detail. Many of them have orthographic views. You can see them from all sides with a little silhouette of a human, so you don't have to look at stats to know, okay, it's twice as high as you are, or it's, you know,
oh, that's nice.
It's about this big. That's a really big thing for the creature manual, is capturing that visual kind of style that we're now known for, and it does it well.
Excellent. And did you have anything else planned beyond the creatures book? That you can talk about, I should say.
Oh, yeah. The equipment manual is being written at the moment, and that's going to drastically increase the already large selection of weaponry and armor and equipment in the book. And it's really, we're going to put the same production value into that book, and it's just going to focus exclusively on weapons, armor, and your standard equipment.
Excellent. Real quick, just want to touch on the what sources of inspiration you guys might have had for where did this all come from? You know,
it all comes from it's sort of all the earliest inspiration for Alpha Omega was ancient astronaut theory and guys like Alan Alford and Zechariah Sitchin, Eric von Daniken. I was reading them years and years ago, like when I was in high school.
Sure.
And I thought that was such an intriguing idea, that these ancient alien races had visited Earth. And the idea of sort of bridging the gap between ancient alien theory and horror is really what the genesis of Alpha Omega. And so that's sort of where it all originally came from. And then once Dave and I started working on it together, it just really exploded into a really big, well-detailed world with lots going on. So, yeah.
That sounds fantastic. I think you guys have a really good product. It looks beautiful.
Oh, nice.
It's definitely something that you're not seeing anywhere else. And I personally like to see games like this come out and that aren't affiliated with any of the big companies. You know, so it's nice to see some original stuff come out again.
Yeah.
Well, I want to definitely thank you guys for taking the time out to talk to me today.
Thank you for taking your time.
Yeah, no problem. And I hope you guys have a great con. You know.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Deep within the heart of the slums in the rat-ridden city of Punjar, the Beggar King weaves his plots. From the tile rooftops to the filthy alley sewers, even the bravest of sellswords tremble before the Beggar King's fell secrets. Now you must bring his reign to an end.
For more information, visit www.vorpalnetwork.com or www.canadiancrusaders.com.
Sellswords of Punjar, an adventure for characters of levels 1 to 3.
Published by Goodman Games.
This concludes the broadcast from World Control.
You've been listening to the Gamers Haven Podcast. You can find us on the web at www.canadiancrusaders.com. The Gamers Haven Podcast is a member of the Vorpal Network at www.vorpalnetwork.com. Gamers Haven and Thousand Monkey Productions are copyright 2008 and is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Sharealike 3.0 United States license, some rights reserved. Stop by our website to check out our actual play feed, fill out our feedback guest book, or hit us on the forums. Music on the show is used with permission by Joe Hero Band, www.joehero.com. And this has been a Thousand Monkeys production.